Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Brian Lin. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
Jin Yong-sun was in his early 20s when he fled North Korea during the Korean War. He left behind two sisters and a brother. Nearly 70 years later, Jin still has not spoken to or seen his family since. "I cannot even express my sadness in words," says Jin, who is now 89 years old and living in Seoul. "I miss my family as much as ever." For Jin and other Koreans who left family behind in the early 1950s, time is quickly running out to see their family on the other side of the border. Relations between North and South Korea have worsened in recent months. Plans for government-approved family reunions are often delayed. For many, it is already too late. 60% of South Koreans who have registered for family reunions since 1988 had already died as of last month. Those numbers come from South Korea's Unification Ministry. Among the nearly 54,000 survivors, 23% are 90 or older, and 41% are in their 80s, the ministry says. At 74, Ling Sung-won is among the younger North Koreans who fled during the war. He came to South Korea during the United Nations-led Hungnam evacuation in 1950. He was 5 years old. He has difficulty remembering his family. "It's just been too long," says Lee. Since 1985, 21 rounds of family reunions have reconnected a total of 4,355 individuals and 1,757 families. Such events have taken place less often in recent years. The parents of South Korean President Moon Jae-in also left North Korea during the Hungnam evacuation. He has discussed the importance of restarting the family reunions. In a statement last month, Moon said restarting the family reunions is highest priority for the two Koreas. "It's wrong that governments in both the South and the North have not given them even a chance for such a long time," Moon said. The most recent reunions took place a little over 1 year ago at North Korea's Mount Kumgang Resort. It included 83 North Koreans and 89 South Koreans. More had been invited to take part, but they chose not to attend after discovering their family members across the border had already died. I'm Susan Shand.
Attendees of the White House's second state dinner of the Trump presidency on Friday will see some new personal touches from the First Lady, Melania Trump. There are new wall coverings in the Red Room, new window treatments in the Green Room, and restored furniture in the Blue Room. Those are just some of the home improvement projects the First Lady has overseen to keep the public areas of the White House looking their best. Stuart McLaurin is president of the White House Historical Association. He said sunlight had left the wall in the Red Room so faded it was almost pink. He added, "Those rooms should always look their very best, and it was just very faded and really, really needed to be done." First ladies meet often with experienced White House workers to decide what improvements should be at the top of the to-do list. As First Lady, Melania Trump has centered on her interest in history as she oversees improvement projects. At a recent event, she said, "Our family is grateful to live in this true symbol of our nation's history, but we are even more honored to play a part in restoring and enhancing our country's sacred landmark." McLaurin said the First Lady designed a new floor covering for the diplomatic reception room. The new rug includes the state flowers of all 50 American states. Last year, the First Lady returned an historic set of furniture to the Blue Room. President James Monroe brought the furniture to the White House in 1817. But in 1860, nearly all of the pieces were sold. The White House has brought back 10 of the original pieces. The rest were lost to history, McLaurin said. The White House serves several purposes. It is an office for the president and his staff, a home for his family, and a museum for the public. About 500,000 people visit the White House every year. Heads of states and important people attend receptions and other events held there. This Friday, the Trumps will hold a state dinner for Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison and his wife. The White House does get a lot of wear and tear, McLaurin said, and making changes to the White House is more complex than doing so in private homes. Ideas for improvement projects need to be shared with the Committee for the Preservation of the White House. It provides advice on how to keep the public rooms of the White House in good condition. The committee then asks for money from the Historical Association. The association spends about $1 million to $1.5 million on such projects each year.
Facial recognition technology is already widely used by governments, law enforcement, and some advertising companies. The technology uses machine learning tools to search for faces in an attempt to identify people. Now, these systems are also being used to identify animals. In a recent study, scientists announced they had developed machine learning tools to track the faces of individual wild chimpanzees. The study was led by researchers from Britain's University of Oxford. The results were published in science advances. Dan Schofield is a researcher and doctoral student working in Oxford's Primate Models Lab. He said in a statement that the system was developed to improve the quality of information collected about chimpanzees in the wild over a long period of time. For species like chimpanzees, which have complex social lives and live for many years, getting snapshots of their behavior from short-term field research can only tell us so much, Schofield said. The researchers wanted to get a more complete understanding of the lives of the chimpanzees by studying them over several generations. But doing this would have required searching through hundreds of hours of video recordings of chimpanzees in the wild. The video recordings that the researchers studied captured the activities of a group of chimpanzees that lived in the West African nation of Guinea. The video collection began in 1988. It was created as an outdoor laboratory by researchers at Japan's Kyoto University. A facial recognition computer model was trained using more than 10 million images of the animals. The model was then used to search, recognize, and track individual chimpanzees. The researchers said that the machine learning tools were effective even when processing poor quality images in different lighting conditions. The team said the system was able to identify individual chimpanzees correctly about 92% of the time. It successfully identified the animal's sex 96% of the time. The study included an experiment with humans to see how they could perform against the machine learning system in making identifications. The human subjects were able to correctly identify individual chimpanzees about 42% of the time. The study also noted that the machine learning tool was much faster at completing the experiment. Human experts took about 55 minutes, while the computer took only seconds. The researchers say they are permitting other scientists to use the system for similar projects. They hope the method will be used with other species to record animal behavior and monitor different animal populations in the environment. Facial recognition technology is also being used with other animals. The New York Times reported earlier this year that several Chinese companies were developing facial recognition systems to track pigs. Most of the systems aim to improve feeding methods and search for sick animals. A company based in Ireland has developed a system to collect video data on milk-producing cows. The company, called Canthus, says the technology collects information on eating, health, and reproduction. The information is immediately available to farmers to help manage the animals' activities. In the United States, researchers at the University of Kentucky are working to create a facial recognition system to help identify cows spread over large areas of land. The system would use drones or small unpiloted aircraft to search for the cows. The researchers are asking local farmers to send in pictures of cows to be used in the project. They will be used to help build a machine learning tool that will be taught to recognize different breeds, age, and the sex of cows. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. They created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we discussed the way the delegates agreed that states would be represented in the national government. There would be two houses in the legislature. In one house, the House of Representatives, the number of representatives from each state would depend on the state's population. In the other house, the Senate, all states would have an equal number of representatives. The agreement on representation was known as the Great Compromise. Not all the delegates in Philadelphia were pleased with it, but it saved the convention from failure. The debate on representation in the House raised an important issue. No one wanted to talk about it, but all the delegates knew they had to discuss it. The issue was slavery. There were thousands of slaves in the United States in 1787. Most of them were in southern states. But there were many slaves in the north, too. And northern ship owners made a lot of money by importing slaves from Africa. A modern-day Supreme Court justice, Clarence Thomas, came from a family whose ancestors included slaves. Justice Thomas says slavery made no sense in America.
How can you have a free country with slaves? We understood that. It's a contradiction. It contradicts the very founding premise of the country.
The Articles of Confederation said nothing about slavery. Each state could decide to allow it or not. Massachusetts, for example, made slavery illegal. Nine other states stopped importing new slaves. Only three states, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, continued to import slaves. The issue was never easy to discuss. Some of the most important men in America, including George Washington and James Madison, owned slaves. No one wanted to insult these men, yet the delegates at the convention had to make some decisions about slavery. Slavery affected laws on trade and taxes, as well as the question of representation in Congress. If the number of representatives in the House was based on a state's population, who would you count? Would you count just free people, or would you count slaves too? Akhil Reed Amar, a professor of law and political science at Yale University, calls slavery the original sin of America's founders.
They inherited it, to be sure, and they worried about it, but not enough.
During the debate, some delegates argued that slaves were property and should not be counted for purposes of representation. Others argued that slaves were people and should be counted with everyone else. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania made an angry speech. He denounced slavery as an evil institution. Charles Pinckney of South Carolina defended the existence of slavery in the United States. In all ages, he said, one half of mankind have been slaves. George Mason of Virginia, a slave owner, wanted to free all slaves. He said Virginia attempted to do that when it was a British colony, but that the British government refused. He blamed the problem on British businessmen who made money from slavery. Other delegates rose to denounce or defend slavery, but no one at the convention had the power to rule on whether slavery was right or wrong. Everyone knew the convention would fail if they tried to write a constitution that banned slavery. The southern states would never accept it. They would refuse to be part of the United States. Rufus King of Massachusetts said, "The convention should consider slavery only as a political matter." And that was what happened. The delegates accepted several political compromises on the issue. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, for example, proposed a method of counting each state's population for purposes of representation. All white people and other free citizens would be counted as one person each. Every five slaves would be counted only as three people. This was called the three-fifths rule. The delegates accepted it. The word slave was never used in the Constitution. The document simply used the words all other persons. The three-fifths rule remained the law until the 14th Amendment to the Constitution came into effect in 1868. Alexander Hamilton said the three-fifths compromise was necessary. Without it, he said, no union could possibly have been formed. Slavery also became an issue when the delegates began discussing the powers of the national legislature. Once again, the delegates asked, are slaves people or are they property? The answer would affect import taxes and the growth of new states. The delegates accepted several compromises on these questions, too. They agreed that the Treasury could collect a tax of $10 for every imported slave. They also agreed that slaves could be imported until 1808. Then, no new slaves could be brought into the country. Until then, each state had the power to make its own decisions about slavery. After 1808, the national government would make all the decisions. Constitutional law professor Akhil Reed Amar says that agreement is where the delegates went wrong.
What was the founders' biggest mistake? Not that they didn't get rid of slavery immediately. It was already a part of their world. It would have been difficult to get rid of slavery immediately. But what they didn't do is come up with a long-term plan to get rid of slavery eventually.
Debate on the Constitution continued through the summer of 1787. At the same time, some of the delegates raised an important question. Once the document was written, who would approve it? The state legislatures? The people? Or, as Governor Morris proposed, one big national convention? Elbridge Gerry opposed giving that power to the people. The people, he said, have the wildest ideas of government in the world. James Madison disagreed. He believed the people must ratify their new plan of government. Madison considered the difference between a system founded on the legislatures only and one founded on the people to be the true difference between a league or treaty and a constitution. When the debate was over, the delegates agreed that the people should ratify the new constitution through conventions held in each state. Justice Clarence Thomas and law professor Akhil Reed Amar have described this agreement as one of the most remarkable parts of the convention.
You think of the going to Washington and trying to get him to leave Mount Vernon, and he doesn't want to leave because he's finally back home. He'd been away over 4 years, and he didn't want to leave. And he goes to Philadelphia, and they do it. They come up with this document, what, 4 months, and now you have it. It's going to the Congress, and it's going to be sent to the people, too.
To the people,
to ratify.
Amazing.
Finally, the delegates had to decide how many yes votes by states would be needed to ratify the Constitution. Any changes to the Articles of Confederation needed ratification by all 13 states. The Philadelphia Convention was called only to change those articles, not to replace them. So all 13 states would have to approve. But several delegates said this would be impossible. After all, Rhode Island never sent a representative to Philadelphia. That state was sure to reject the Constitution. Also, as everyone knew, the Philadelphia Convention went far past the point of changing the Articles of Confederation. The delegates wrote a completely new plan of government. But that meant they could agree to accept ratification by fewer than 13 states. Delegates who supported a strong central government wanted to quickly put the question to a vote. How many states were needed to ratify? By the end of the day, the convention had not decided. But early the next day, the delegates voted, and the number they agreed on was 9. The convention in Philadelphia was nearing the end of its work. The delegates needed only to write out their agreements in final form and sign the document.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.